Chapter 38. Within 3 years. I have more of earth now than I desire, and less of heaven. Mary Baker Eddy, 1907. By the end of February, many of the workers who had been called to Pleasant View had returned to their homes, though others had been called, one of whom was Lydda Fitzpatrick. On March 1st, Mrs. Eddy asked Henry Baker to come to Pleasant View to see her. Honorable Henry M. Baker was a distinguished lawyer, an ex-member of Congress, and a present member of the New Hampshire legislature. He was a resident of Bow, New Hampshire, and he was also related to Mrs. Eddy. She and Henry's father were cousins. Henry Baker had been to Pleasant View many times over the years, and on several occasions, Mrs. Eddy had consulted him on legal points. On March 1st, she wanted his opinion on a letter she had just received. The letter was from Washington, D.C., was dated February 25th, 1907, and was signed by George W. Glover. But Mrs. Eddy said to her cousin, quote, George could not write that letter. That letter was written by an educated man, skilled in the use of language, end quote. She asked Henry what it meant, and his response was that, quote, unquestionably, some hostile action was contemplated, end quote. The next day, the hostile action was obvious to all. Headlines in the New York World proclaimed, Relatives sue to wrest Mother Eddy's fortune from control of clique. Chandler had come up with a diabolical plan. On March 1st, he had filed in the Superior Court for the County of Merrimack, New Hampshire, a petition wherein Mary Baker Eddy, as plaintiff, was suing against Calvin A. Fry, Alfred Farlow, Irving C. Tomlinson, Ira O. Knapp, William B. Johnson, Stephen A. Chase, Joseph Armstrong, Edward A. Kimball, Herman S. Herring, and Lewis C. Strang, and requesting that a receiver be appointed to take possession of all her property, including copyrights. The petition, as well as extensive lurid newspaper articles, stated that Mrs. Eddy was incompetent to handle her own affairs and her vast fortune, which was greatly exaggerated. So her son, granddaughter, and nephew, George W. Glover, Mary Baker Glover, and George W. Baker, respectfully, were acting on her behalf to wrest her and her property from the despotic control of the 10 defendants. Through smooth-tongued villainy, all the Glovers were deceived into believing that this was true. The nephew, too, was totally misled, and Chandler very adroitly kept George Baker and the Glovers from meeting. In a letter to his cousin Mary, written in 1909, George said, I do wish, Mary, that I could have met you when you have been east. I proposed such a meeting to Mr. Chandler, but while he heartily, quote, wished it might be, end quote, he never arranged to let me know of the visit of your father and yourself in such a way as to allow of a meeting. Sometimes I've wondered why. Perhaps William Dana Orcutt's reaction to this bombshell, dropped by the New York World and the Boston Herald on the 2nd of March, was typical of all who knew Mrs. Eddy. He wrote in later years, I doubt if anyone associated with Mrs. Eddy at that time was more distinctly shocked than those of us at the university press. We had become familiar through the years with Mrs. Eddy's indefatigable energy and continuing activity in connection with the revision of each new edition of Science and Health. The shock was intensified by our definite knowledge of the malicious nature of the attack. Within the period when the citation charged Mrs. Eddy with being mentally incompetent to conduct her business affairs, we had received communications and alterations written in her unforgettable hand, which in themselves should have been sufficient evidence to dismiss the suit. This fantastic falsehood that Mrs. Eddy was non compos mentis and controlled by others from the moment of its publication spread like wildfire all over America. Pleasant View was flooded with telegrams and letters of support, and Concord was once again invaded by reporters. A letter dated March 3rd from George and Elizabeth Kinter from their home in Chicago ended with, quote, "In behalf of Mrs. Kinter as well as myself, I remain ready for instant service anywhere," end quote. Within a very few days, George Kinter was back serving at Pleasant View. A letter of March 4th was received by Laura Sargent and was from Ebenezer Foster Eddy in Waterbury, Vermont. Benny had written Mrs. Eddy a supportive letter during the Woodbury trial, and now he wrote once more, supporting his adopted mother in this latest diabolical plot to separate her from her closest students and from her money. Benny's letter to Laura stated, quote, "I believe her perfect demonstration will be of more value to the world than all the money in it," end quote. Foster Eddy's statement was the absolute truth, but though he could voice it, he seemed unable to uphold the truth he had stated. The world did not offer him, quote, "all the money," end quote, in the world. But whatever the smooth-tongued of James Slott did offer a day or two later was accepted and turned Benny against his mother. This son could not have been as misled as was George Glover, for Benny had had charge of Mrs. Eddy's business account books, otherwise kept by Calvin Fry, for about 2 years, and his name had appeared on the title page of Science and Health as publisher for a great many editions over a period of several years. Foster Eddy was not the only relative approached. A second cousin, Fred W. Baker, was enlisted in support of Chandler's action. On March 11th, petitions were filed wherein Ebenezer J. Foster Eddy and Fred W. Baker joined in the bill filed by the three other relatives. Fred's sister, Mrs. Joseph P. Edmond, was astounded by her brother's action. When she was interviewed by the Boston Post, she stated that Chandler had spent an entire evening trying to persuade her to join in, but it was clear to her that all those involved were, quote, "actuated by revenge or mercenary motives," end quote, which could not influence her. She stated, quote, "I know nothing about Mrs. Eddy's personal affairs nor her money matters, and care less," end quote. Within the next 2 months, her brother Fred Baker withdrew from the case. The New York World led the public to believe that George Glover was the instigator of this suit, and this deception was perpetuated by transferring Chandler's attacks to the front pages of the Boston Herald. If Joseph Pulitzer did not own controlling interest in the Herald, there must have been collusion between the two newspapers, because it became obvious to the astute observer that this case was being tried in the newspapers, most particularly the Boston Herald, rather than in the courtroom. When General Streeter gave a press interview early in March, he stated that he had sent a copy of the bill in equity as published to Mrs. Eddy early Saturday morning, March 2nd. But as far as he had been informed, it had not yet been served on any of the defendants. Streeter was very discreet in his statements, but he did give a good deal of accurate information, including, in common with her many friends, she, Mrs. Eddy, believes that the initiative in these proceedings was not taken by her son or other relatives. The amount of Mrs. Eddy's property has been grossly multiplied by rumor and unfounded report. She is not possessed of large wealth, as this term is used. With my partner, Mr. Alan Hollis, I am counsel for Mrs. Eddy alone. So far as this case can be considered a legitimate proceeding in equity, it seems to be an attempt to have the personal rights and privileges of a citizen adjudicated in a way unprecedented in New Hampshire. On Monday, March 4th, Mrs. Eddy sent a message to her cousin, Henry Baker, asking him to come to Pleasant View. She explained to him that she wanted to be relieved of the care of her property and asked if he would be willing to be one of her trustees to handle it for her. On the afternoon of March 6th, he and the two other trustees, Archibald McClellan and Josiah E. Fernald, met at Pleasant View with Mrs. Eddy, Mr. Streeter, and Fred N. Ladd. George Kinter and Calvin Fry were also present during at least a part of the interview. Mr. Streeter had drawn up the deed of trust, and Mrs. Eddy read one copy aloud, while General Baker followed in the second copy. She stopped several times to make comments such as, quote, "That is just what I want," end quote. Fred Ladd recalled that once she stopped and said, quote, "You will note that I am reading this without glasses, and I do not have to hold it way off either," end quote. This is of special interest to those who know that Mrs. Eddy had had many pairs of reading glasses in earlier years. According to a statement by Josiah Fernald, when she came to the end, she said in substance, quote, "I understand that I am giving up the control of all my property, but I want to sign this deed," end quote, and asked Mr. Streeter where she should sign. He pointed out the place on the paper, and she signed each of the two originals, remarking, as she did so, something to the effect that her hand was not quite so steady today as usual. After General Baker signed the acceptance, her attention was called to his signature, and she joked him because he could not write so well as she could. General Baker also stated that some fun was made of his signature, in which she laughingly joined. But her next order of business that afternoon was the following for Mr. Ladd. "I hereby appoint Fred N. Ladd, my attorney, to take all papers and all the contents of my safe boxes at First National Bank in Concord, New Hampshire, and transfer them to the trustees that I have today selected." Probably Calvin Fry was very pleased to turn over all his books and papers, as well as responsibility in their regard, to the trustees. One of the first things the trustees did was to have a reputable accounting firm audit Mrs. Eddy's cash account books for the 14 years prior to March 6, 1907. Their report verified that on that date, $871,861.46 in bonds, cash, etc., had been transferred to the trustees. This firm, Harvey Chase & Company, also affirmed that Calvin Fry was an honest agent, but not a very good accountant, that he had made more errors against himself than against Mrs. Eddy, and that the trustees owed him close to $700. Most likely, the attorneys for all the defendants, including Mrs. Eddy, advised this audit for the, quote, next friends, end quote, suit. Mrs. Eddy, of course, was the main defendant, though falsely listed as plaintiff. Mrs. Eddy had refused to see any of the army of newsmen in Concord and appointed Irving C. Tomlinson to be her messenger in this area. He was dealing with a belligerent group of calloused reporters who were looking for a scandal, and some of whom were determined to see Mrs. Eddy. Mr. Tomlinson dealt graciously with their boorish behavior, and one of them told him later, "We hoped that something of a sensational nature would be uncovered. If ever anyone has a right to hate someone, surely the Christian Scientists had a right to hate us. We were there to vilify Mrs. Eddy if we could. We had no reverence and no decency. We did not believe anything but the worst about anybody, and we wanted, if possible, to hold Mrs. Eddy up to scorn and ridicule, to expose and denounce her." Once again, the leader set an example of blessing those who, quote, despitefully use you and persecute you, end quote. She asked Mr. Tomlinson to call these men on the telephone and tell them it was impossible for her to see them. She also instructed him to speak only to the head man and give him a further message for this man. The chief man was a steady drinker and a particularly hard-boiled reporter from a big New York newspaper who had been for some years afflicted with a cancerous growth of the throat, which was at times extremely painful and overwhelming. He was suffering greatly and unable to speak a word on the evening that Mr. Tomlinson phoned. All the men were gathered in his room at the Eagle Hotel, smoking, drinking, and bored, when the phone rang and Mr. Tomlinson asked to speak to the leading man. The reporter who answered said he was too ill to come to the phone and couldn't talk anyway. Remembering Mrs. Eddy's instructions, I said, quote, "Tell him to come to the telephone. He can hear what I say, even if he can't talk," end quote. Accordingly, the suffering newspaper man came to the telephone, showing decided anger, as I was later informed. He listened for a few moments. Those in the room, of course, could not hear what was being said. But when this man turned away from the telephone, he not only could speak perfectly, but was healed. The healing stirred these men. They sat around looking at each other, unable to comprehend what had happened, and more startled by it than anything else. They had, of course, heard that Christian Scientists claimed to heal the sick, and they knew their comrade had been healed. These men had believed Mrs. Eddy to be only a humbug, and the reputed healings of Christian Science to be a great hoax. Their whole position was overthrown by this proof offered before their very eyes. They packed their bags and left. Many years later, a nephew of this reporter called at Mr. Tomlinson's office in Boston and said that he had a message for him from his uncle. Quote, "My uncle requested me to see you and to tell you that in his last days he turned to Christian Science, and he knew that he owed a debt of gratitude to Mrs. Eddy for his healing in Concord." End quote. The trial in 1902 edition of Science and Health states, quote, "Materia medica, anatomy, physiology, and hypnotism are the pretended friends of man." End quote. Following the filing of the next friend's suit in 1907, Mrs. Eddy changed, quote, "pretended friends," end quote, in Science and Health to, quote, "next friends," end quote. After the trial was over, she changed, quote, "next friends," end quote, in the trial in Science and Health to, quote, "envy, greed, and ingratitude," end quote. Science and Health, page 430. On March 7th, the lesson the leader gave her household included, what is the one evil? Animal magnetism? Yes. Is it person? No. Is it anything? No. Then we cannot be harmed by it. That is what I mean by the one evil. That same day, she wrote two letters to Mrs. Stetson in New York. Her first letter said, "My dear student, I cannot believe that you are forgetting your duty to your teacher and leader. So I write to you myself to learn of you why my three recent requests that you would send to me a spring bonnet have not been even noticed. Please answer this, my letter, and put on the envelope personal. Then none but myself need see it. Do not allow the evil one in your midst to turn you away from me in this hour of crucifixion, or history will repeat itself, and Christian Science will once more be lost as aforetime. The leading students must not allow this attempt of the enemy to overcome them, and you yield to it. The lies that are told about me or what I say of you are not worth your notice nor mine. Quote, awake, arise from the dead, and God will give you life. End quote. As ever, lovingly, your teacher, friend, helper. The leader knew the tendency of her students, as well as everyone else, to personalize evil. So later the same day, she wrote Augusta again. Beloved, by the, quote, evil one, end quote, I by no means refer to a personality, but to the one evil. In other words, hypnotism, or malicious animal magnetism. In haste, your loving teacher. But the, quote, evil one, end quote, was using many personalities in this all-out war to overcome the woman. Every day the Boston Herald carried front-page stories, lies about Mrs. Eddy and her history. McClure's February and March issues revived the Quimby myth while discrediting God's chosen messenger. William Nixon had presented his bitter accounts of Mrs. Eddy and Christian Science to Georgine Millamine and Willa Cather. And on March 9th, Nixon wrote to Laura Fulmer that Frederick Peabody had offered him a chance, quote, to make some money with the people he was working for and within the anti-Eddy litigation, end quote. A publisher had suggested that Lyman Powell write a book answering the questions he had raised in his pamphlet, The Anarchy of Christian Science, and the rector was getting much of his information from Mrs. Eddy's enemies, including Georgine Melmine. Quote, the heathen raged, end quote. And Mrs. Eddy said to her household on March 8th, God gives us the victory. His plan is made long before we know anything about it. Then we have to carry it out. The human heart requires many scourgings, sometimes before it falls in line, but it must come. We must not feel too much encouraged over a victory, for everything in mortal mind must be overcome. If you fail in one iota, like an example in mathematics, every figure right but one, the example is incorrect. So it is with our problem. All little things must be overcome. Then we rise above substance matter, and that includes sin, sickness, and death. Even those nearest the leader had little idea how far she had already risen above substance matter. She was working out the problem of being, not for herself alone, but as the example and the way for all to follow in all time to come. If Jesus' disciples had held up the hands of God's masculine idea, the science he practiced would not have been lost for centuries. But the world was too much with them. Now God's feminine idea was endeavoring to elevate her disciples above the world. She said to them on March 9th, what is a wayshower? There is a human and a divine meaning. A wayshower is that which shows the way. It must be something or someone. Jesus was the wayshower, the Christ with him. And if he had not been, where would we be? He showed the way as the masculine idea of principle. Then woman took it up at that point, the ascending thought in the scale, and is showing the way, thus representing the male and female principle, the male and female of God's creating. Is there anything in the world of more importance than holding up the hands of the wayshower? No. If they had all done that with Jesus, we would be in the millennium. We must become unselfed. The next day, March 10th, Calvin Fry recorded, quote, while Mrs. Eddy was troubled today at the lawsuit just instituted by her next friends, Glover and Baker, she prayed God for direction and opened her Bible to Isaiah 16, lines 12, 13, and 14. This gave her renewed courage, end quote. The leader said to her students, quote, from the beginning and all the way along, I got my leading from God through the Bible. Today he is speaking to me again, end quote. Then she read to them from Isaiah 16. But now the Lord hath spoken, saying, within 3 years, as the years of an hireling, and the glory of Moab shall be contemned with all that great multitude, and the remnant shall be very small and feeble. The leader added, quote, I am sure this will be fulfilled, but don't tell anyone about it, end quote. Perhaps no one but Mrs. Eddy had any idea what this meant. But God had spoken to her, especially in Isaiah 16:12. And it shall come to pass, when it is seen that Moab is weary on the high place, that he shall come to his sanctuary to pray, but he shall not prevail. The leader had come to her sanctuary often, and often to pray for her followers, her children, her church. She had constantly stood before them, quote, on the high place, end quote, and she had entreated them in every way she knew to come up. But it seemed that she had to go down to them. It is not easy to go down to the level of others and still stay, quote, on the high place, end quote. Little wonder that she was weary on the high place. All of her followers had been riding along on her demonstration, and she was ever praying to bring them up to where she was. But on March 10, 1907, God told her that this prayer, quote, shall not prevail, end quote. You can help others, but you cannot do their work for them. From that day, the leader knew that her glory was to be removed from them, quote, and the remnant shall be very small and feeble, end quote, when they no longer have her to lean upon. To help the feeble remnant, the mother gave her children an explanation of what would appear to them as, quote, seeming decease, end quote. At that time, the chapter, quote, Science, Theology, Medicine, end quote, in Science and Health, ended with line 16 on page 164. In the third edition of 1907, Mrs. Eddy added the paragraph which began, if you or I should appear to die, we should not be dead. And this seeming decease, caused by a majority of human beliefs that we must die, would not in the least disprove Christian Science. And which ends the chapter with Paul's declaration, quote, death is swallowed up in victory, end quote. At this time, quote, Christian Science practice, end quote, in Science and Health, ended with the sentence, quote, Christ, truth, gives mortals temporary food and clothing until the material transformed with the ideal disappears and man is clothed and fed spiritually, end quote. For many, many years, Mrs. Eddy had been the teacher, guide, wayshower, urging her students to greater endeavors in this necessary transformation. In three more years, they would be on their own. She had given them the, quote, little book, end quote, from the hand of the angel, but they would have the mother no longer to instruct, direct, correct them. They would have to work out their own salvation. In the fifth edition, in 1907 of the textbook, the leader added lines 16 to 29 to the end of, quote, Christian Science practice, end quote, on page 442, which included Paul's admonition. But she was still the mother, tempering Paul's, quote, fear and trembling, end quote, with Jesus's gentle promise. St. Paul says, quote, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, end quote. Jesus said, quote, fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom, end quote. This truth is Christian Science.